Hey folks, unfortunately I have to start this episode of the Citadel Cafe off with an apology. The Audio Hijack Pro software that I used to record the show updated between last episode and this episode, and I caught the changes to the stream audio in time for the show, but never checked the local recording. And unfortunately, everything that recorded is overdriven, so there's going to be a lot of audio clipping. There's a lot of, I guess, gain issues that I've tried my best to, I guess, balance out in GarageBand. It's incredibly embarrassing. Normally the show quality is at least, you know, on par with a lot of other podcasts out there. So I apologize for the assault to your ear holes that you're about to experience, but I cannot scrap this episode because the conversation that we had with Bill was just so good, and especially the conversation in and around the Kickstarter. So if you guys can just bear with us for this one episode, I am hard at work on fixing the audio issues. Again, I've adjusted the volume so your eardrums will not be blown to smithereens. Unfortunately, it makes us feel like first-time podcasters. So again, sorry for the audio quality. Moving forward, we will hopefully have this issue nicked in the next episode. And we can start the show as soon as you gentlemen are ready to go.
Let me get one small sip of Merlot here and we're good to go.
You go right ahead. I am now slightly jealous.
This is the Citadel Cafe. This is the Citadel Cafe, episode number 57, recorded live on Wednesday, March 13th, 2013. I am Joel Duggan of StarCrossedOnline.com. To my right is Mr. Peyton Francis of CardboardTreehouse.com. Peyton, how are you doing this evening?
Very well, sir. Very well. Happy New Pope Day.
New Pope Day. Did that happen?
Yes. That happened today. Yes.
Ah, I couldn't tell whether the tweets were ironic and impatient or whether they were actually factual.
Yeah, I think it's going to be Pope Francis the First, so I hope they call him Pope Frank the Tank. That'd be awesome.
Nice. Anyway, nice. Is it the Canadian guy?
No, he's from Argentina.
Argentina, okay. Yeah. It's a good Argentine mob name. Frankie the Pope. Very, very cool. The third chair this evening is none other than Mr. Bill Meeks of Meeks Mixed Media, and greetings from Storybrooke. Welcome back to the show.
Thank you for the welcome. I'm glad to be here.
Yeah,
no better way to spend a Wednesday night.
Well, we like to think so.
Yeah.
And if you listener happen to be new to the Citadel Cafe, this is where myself and a couple friends come to hang out and talk about the geeky stuff that we are into. We're not myopic, though. If it's fantasy, sci-fi, sometimes just cool things we find online, books, apps, websites, television, we kind of cover it all. And I don't know, I feel like there's been just so much going on online lately that I haven't consumed much large, you know, portions of media. I feel like I've been saying this every show, but I've noticed this plethora of just people putting stuff out there all the time. I'm spending far less time on my Facebook page because it is spam. Like there is nothing good there anymore, which has always been the case, but it's gotten worse. But then Twitter, I feel like I've somehow managed to eliminate most of it. And now it's like I get up in the morning and I have breakfast. And I've always thought, you know, where I work from home and I don't have cable, so I don't watch local news. And, you know, you go to social events and people are talking about, oh, this robbery that happened on this thing, or this fire that happened here, or the local legislature that's passing for this. And I don't know anything because I haven't been keeping up with the news. So I thought, well, you know, I'll start following the Chronicle Herald and local papers and stuff like that on Twitter. And so that's what I do in the morning, is I comb over the headlines and stuff like that. So I rewind my Twitter feed to, like, you know, 5 a.m. when all of the news sources are kind of posting all their stuff, 5 or 6 a.m. And I've noticed that in, I guess, best practices in what I've been doing, that I've kind of culled out all of the spammy tweet sort of situations. And it takes me a long time. Like, if I really want to read my Twitter feed, I'm honest to God interested in it. Like, every second tweet is something that I really want to follow through, sometimes I have to hit read later because it turns out to be like a 6-page tech article. But like a lot of times I'm really genuinely interested in what people are saying. And I spend a lot of time consuming that. So it's been cutting into the video podcast time and the, you know, watching stuff at night sort of, I guess, time that we set aside usually, you know, for TV and whatnot. So that's what I've been doing this week. Peyton, what about you?
I've just been basically working, hobbling around the house.
Hobbling?
Yeah. I was going upstairs the other day, and I discovered that a piggy toe cannot support 250 pounds.
Oh, jeez.
So, anyways, that's the first time it's happened to me, but I just lost my balance going down the stairs, and so that basically buggered up my pinky toe, buggered up my knee, and then my hip. So I've been basically gimping around now. I'm getting old, man.
As you say, you're an old man.
Yeah. But other than that, I've just been plugging through the storyboards for that project I'm working on.
Oh, nice.
And, I still can't say much more than that. I'm working on something, but the emotional content of it is pretty raw.
And, oh, yes.
Mm-hmm. So I hit a couple of the major themes there today, and I got them wrapped up. And so I'm sitting in a Starbucks, like just doing rough thumbnail storyboards, almost like, you know, just eyes full of tears, right? As I'm drawing in the Starbucks by myself, like a nutbag. The thing that happened when I was writing the initial proposal, I was sitting there. I had to stop twice because I was tearing up. But anyway, so it'll be a fun piece when it comes out.
Yeah, anyway. Not called Happy Town. That's
Happy
for sure.
Town, not,
that's
but you know, sure. But it'll be an interesting piece. I'll probably be around for a while. I hope. Anyway, enough of that mystery sort of stuff. What's going on with you, Mr. Meeks?
Not too much. Well, it's been a really good week, and you know, we're looking to move in about a month or so. So it's mainly there's been a lot of like looking at houses, emailing people, eliminating the 90% of spam that responds, all that stuff, and you know, just chugging along great until today. Then today kind of got me in a little bit of a bad mood, but I'm shaking all that off so I can talk to you guys. And I'm sure we'll discuss the reason why I'm in a bad mood a little later.
We probably will. I think you and I might be frustrated for the same sort of reason.
As two people who have done the thing that we're upset about, I could understand that situation.
Yeah. Teaser, insert here. One thing that I do have to mention, though, before we move on, because I would be remiss if I forgot, is that the last week or so, Chad and his wife were in town with their new daughter, Lena. For those of you new, Chad was third chair on the show for quite a while. Had to kind of bow out because, well, he's got a adorable little girl that has
quite
got
cute.
100% of his attention. She's about 3 months old right now, and so he and Julie and Lena were all down this past week. We got to see them a couple times before they drove back on Monday back to Quebec, and she is adorable. And a big congrats out to Chad and Julie. You know, it's really cool to see. I mean, Chad, someone that I've known for a really long time, be a father now. And I mean, Julie's doing well. Like everything is happy and healthy and hunky dory. And I kid you not, people, the pure entertainment of watching Chad do skinnamarinky dinky dink is worth what I've had to endure over nearly 20 years of friendship with that man. So it's all been worth it as of right now.
Yeah.
One of these days, I will get it on tape. I will get it on video, and it will happen. She's on tape. She's product of my time. Holy crap. You're not the only old man, Peyton. Not the only old man. Well, I guess I can touch on some of the things that I've been watching this week, which is a, I guess, a big kind of section of the show. I have ventured into some new ground, finally. Jocelyn and I have been hunting for a new sci-fi show to watch together. You know, I'll bring up a show that I really like that I've seen, she hasn't, or vice versa. You know, something that she really likes that she's seen that I either am not super into, or she, you know, or she's seen and I haven't. So one of us is always kind of sacrificing that, well, I've seen it and I'll watch it again, but it would be nice to spend the time with you doing something new. So we found V on Netflix here in Canada.
Wow, that's on Netflix?
Okay. Yeah, so we started watching that, and at first I was a little bit, I guess, hesitant because I, you know, I heard that it was good but not great. Started off strong, etc. The more that we watched, two things happened. One, I noticed that it was kind of tropey. Like, essentially, the aliens show up. They look just like people. And they look like very pretty people. And so there's a bit of a resistance. People either like them or they don't. There's a lot of talk about, like, devotion to the aliens and whatnot. And one of the main characters, a teenage boy, does a lot of stupid stuff. And he's old enough to know better. And he's doing it because Laura Vandervoort plays one of the alien Vs, the visitors, and she's stunning. So she's flirty and playing with him, and, you know, she's toying him along and, you know, stripping down into her bra and panties on, like, not command, but whenever she just kind of feels like manipulating him. And he just does all this dumb crap. And you're just like, really? Could we not write something a little bit more interesting than this?
I don't know, man. Just remember when you were a kid.
Oh, no. I'm not saying that it wouldn't happen to a teenager, but I just feel like it's been done before. Like, it happens in every show. But it quickly kind of picked up speed. And one thing that I thought was interesting was that I thought that the reveal of the visitors was a big thing, and it's not. It happens in, like, the first episode, that they're not human, they don't look human, they're reptilian underneath, kind of like a human skin that they've put on. And that's, you know, spoiler-free, that happens right away. But then the cool thing is that there's actually a reptilian resistance. So there's these visitor traitors that are living among humans on Earth that are on the human side. Because it's pretty clear that the visitors don't necessarily have humans' best interests at heart. And that's when I thought, okay, now they've got me. Now the show is interesting. It's got a little bit more of a twist than usual. It's a little reminiscent of Battlestar Galactica, but, you know, like, it still has some interesting quirks to it. The acting is good. Marina Baccarin, I can't remember how to pronounce her last name, of Firefly fame, is very good at playing a lizard lady. There's something very alien about how she just... It's not quite robot, but it's very, like, binary in the emotional sense. Like, it's really unique. And if you're interested at all in that kind of thing, then I would recommend at least checking it out. I mean, hey, it's on Netflix. I mean, you're already paying for it if you've got it, so you might as well go give her a spin. But it's been fun to watch it with Jocelyn and have it be something that we're both experiencing for the first time.
Well, you know, it's a remake, right?
That I didn't.
No, it was
in the
80s.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, it was a real big guy. Yeah, actually, the guy who played Freddy Krueger played one of the resistance guys and stuff.
Robert Englund?
Yeah, thank you.
Oh, right on.
It was real big. Probably about 86, 87, I guess.
Huh.
I
remember. Oh, yeah. It was huge. I've actually never sat down and watched either version, but the reason I know it is because every kid on my block had the little, like, reptile action figures from the miniseries.
And
so
the jackets they wore in the original were very similar to the V sort of Michael Jackson Thriller.
Okay.
It was sort of based on that sort of aesthetic. So
yeah, kind of like an A-line.
Yeah, but the heads were very clearly in the original, like, rubber suit head things.
Oh, I see. Okay.
And they were trying to create a human alien hybrid, I think, in the original series. I have no idea they're doing the new one.
We'll find out, because I think Joss and I are going to at least see the first season through. One thing that we do like about it as well is, again, trouble with last names. Alan Tudyk, who played Wash on Firefly, is in it, and it looks like. He was playing a bad guy, and there's no clear. We don't know yet what the lifespan of these aliens are and what capabilities they have. So it was really cool to see, you know, him play a bad guy, because he's very, very good at it. And both Jocelyn and I like him as a bad guy, and we felt that was kind of something that kind of drove us through the first few episodes. So we're gonna hopefully see where that leads. So, but it's funny that neither one of you guys have seen either the original or this one.
No, I saw the original when it came out.
Oh, you did? Oh, I thought you said you didn't.
No,
that was me. I'm the one who's behind. That's one item on a laundry list of stuff I haven't seen yet. I still haven't, and I promised Brian Brushwood that I would watch this with my son, and I still haven't. It's been like 3 weeks. I've never seen an Indiana Jones movie even.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, that's what happens when you get raised in a household where you're not allowed to watch anything over rated G. Then by the time you're out of the house and you're old enough to appreciate and to get into that kind of stuff, you've kind of lost interest because, you know, girls, things like that. And now I figure I'll spend my 30s catching up.
Yeah, I have a hard time going back. There's a couple things like, you know, Star Wars, the original Superman movie. There's a few things that I watched when I was younger that they sort of hold up. They sort of don't, depending on which movie you're talking about. But the nostalgia is what keeps me, you know, going back to those movies. But for me to go back and watch the original Battlestar Galactica or probably this original V series, I probably couldn't handle it. Like 80s TV, man, I just can't do it.
Yeah, some things are better remembered.
Yeah, although we were talking, Jocelyn and I went out for coffee with a friends of ours the other day, Chris and Julia, and they were making a really kind of astute observation that Julia really likes sitcoms, so that's how she unwinds. You know, she either gets them on DVD or she rents them or she, you know, she downloads or subscribes to them. And so she was watching Perfect Strangers and Full House. And she was like, you know, there's something about some shows that will just stand the test of time. She's like, you know, Perfect Strangers, still funny. You know, the themes are still relevant, you know. But she's like, Full House, annoying as shit. Like, cannot deal. Not funny. Don't know how I watched it so much when I was 12. But, like, you know, and I feel like it's that difference between, like, the shows that were on kind of like Monday nights or Thursday nights and then the ones that were on, like, you know, TGIF on Friday night.
Yeah.
And I feel like there's some shows in the 80s that and some movies that stand up and others that I just, even though they were popular, like I know they would just rub me the wrong way right now. And I don't know how to turn it off.
If you ever want to get rid of the Full House sort of image in your mind, you should watch some of Bob Saget's stand up.
Oh yes. He's foul.
He is foul. It's awesome. It's so funny. Yeah. He basically verbally abuses the audience for most of his show.
Oh jeez.
It's kind of funny. Man.
Peyton, go ahead.
I was just going to say, I think a lot of that really probably depends on how you were exposed and what your relationship was with the show when you were watching it growing up too.
Yeah.
Cause, you know, like me, I can't stand to watch any modern sitcoms. You put on an episode of Boy Meets World, which is something I would generally watch, you know, Friday nights, cuddled up with a blanket, with a, you know, pizza or nachos or a good snack, unwinding from the week. And I can still sit down and watch an episode of that with the laugh track, with the corny jokes, all that kind of stuff. But, you know, something like Full House, it grates after a minute.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know. It's so funny, too. Like, there's a lot of times I want to kind of figure out what some of these child actors are doing now. Because, I mean, sometimes you hear of them, sometimes they've moved on to do stuff, and sometimes you don't even recognize them. You're like, oh, wow, you know, this person that's, you know, starring in this major drama, you know, like some girl on the West Wing or something, it was played someone's neighbor's daughter, you know, in a sitcom when she was 12. And, I mean, people change so much between 12 and 32 that you'd never be able to recognize it.
Yeah. I think Seal's dating one of the Power Rangers now.
Look, I saw an animated GIF the other day on, I think it was Google+, and I'm not usually a fan of this kind of stuff, but I did find it quite funny. It was the green Power Ranger doing a loop of a strut down a boulevard. And I mean, like, leaning back, you know, fists up by the chest, just like, you know, strut, 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 and down at the bottom it was just haters gonna hate.
Nice.
And I was like, nice, okay. Yeah. that got a chuckle out of me. That deserves sharing. Yeah, it was pretty fun. So Peyton, what have you been watching?
Just odds and ends, but one thing caught my eye is Murray Bain from Copernicus posted this on his Facebook today. Apparently a buddy of his is the guy who did it, but Disney is bringing back Mickey Mouse in a series of 19 new retro shorts. And they're all set to go on the Disney Channel and Disney.com. So I posted a link here earlier in the show notes, and that link was killed by Disney. It was on, like, YouTube, I think. I think you can watch it on Disney.com in the States. But in Canada, I got a link here. It's on Daily Motion. But it's Mickey Mouse Croissant de Triomphe?
Triumph.
Okay. Yeah. Anyway, it's a beautiful, beautiful little short. Really, really fun. It looks like it's done in Flash, and you know, or like, you know, some sort of digital animation program, and it's a lot of fun. It's about 3.5 minutes, and definitely worth your time. Lots of great animation and really, really nice stuff. Nice use of limited animation, nice use of full animation. There's a good balance there, and
cool.
Yeah, it's a lot of fun, and the style of the characters are kind of a retro, like Pac-Man eyes and stuff like that.
Okay, yeah.
Like fun, so. You know, I'm sitting here watching this. The animation style with, you know, the way it exaggerates and everything, it almost reminds me like of a John Kay or something, like you know, the guy who did Ren and Stimpy.
Yeah,
it's really interesting and really cool too. Like I was just you know, we went to Disney about a month and a half ago, and I was telling my wife, it's a shame, you know, it's all about the Disney princesses and Tinkerbell, and the old classic Disney characters really don't get an outing unless it's in a preschoolers program like Mickey Mouse Clubhouse or something. Yeah. So it's real nice to see them doing this.
Yeah. Well, the style seems to be herald sort of a mix between the old original 30s sort of rubber hose characters, mm-hmm. but then they sort of married that to some of that 50s Warner Brother, you know, John Kay sensibility, Tex Avery sort of thing.
Like,
it's a nice little bounce there. So.
Yeah, some Maurice Noble in the background a little bit here as I'm
for
watching.
Sure, for sure.
Yeah, it's nice that there's at least some effort going into this kind of stuff. Like, I don't mind limited animation, like you said. I mean, people are going to use computers to make this kind of stuff viable because, I mean, you and I both know, Peyton, that it's labor intensive.
Yeah.
Actually, Bill, you do some like motion graphic animation too, don't you?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I do a fair bit of animation and After Effects, and I've actually been expanding over the past month or two into, I don't know if you guys have heard of Source Filmmaker that Valve put out.
Oh, yes, I did. I think I heard about that on the Instance.
It's basically a cinematic, like a video game cinematics animator kind of thing, and it's really cool. You can, you know, you can import. They have models for any character you could think of, any kind of setting you could think of, and it's really easy and it's quick, which is the important thing. But yeah, I do. But to answer the question, yes, I do. I do a little animation here and there.
Oh, very cool. Yeah. So I mean, anything to make that kind of stuff more affordable, and therefore more profitable is probably a good thing. So I, like I said, if they've got the effort going into some limited animation, then I don't really mind. But to me, what screams effort right now is the backgrounds in this are stunning. Yeah.
Well, the layouts are great. Like, there's nothing cheap about this, right?
No.
They're using whatever tools they're using to the fullest. So
yeah.
It's just beautiful.
Yeah.
I mean, it started off with a good story, really great character designs, and mm-hmm. a lot of personality. So
yeah, and people that know how to animate and know how to animate cartoons. It's one thing that I feel like that has been missing has been the good old Saturday morning cartoon. You know, like the Looney Tunes. You know, 5 minute short for short's sake. You know, for laugh, for kick in the groin. You know, for that kind of stuff. I feel like there's not a lot of that going around right now, and hopefully that's changing. I mean, with YouTube and Vimeo and some other, you know, kind of open content and open distribution models, then you don't have to do 22 minutes or 11 minutes or something, you know, to fit in between commercials and stuff.
Well, Joe Murray tried to do his own network a while ago, and that ended up falling through.
Yeah, well, I don't know that a network is really the way to go either. I mean, I feel like if you're an independent creator or a couple of independent creators, you know, layout guy, animator, you know, editor, and a couple of storyboard guys, I feel like you could probably put some stuff out there, short form, you know, low commitment in your spare time, and build it up to the point where you could even become independent if you use it. I mean, there was a story the other day that I was listening to. I think it was on Tech News Today. They were talking about Vimeo, and Vimeo is trying to create a new model rather than ad supported. So it's not necessarily about the number of viewers; it's about the quality of your viewers. You know.
Yeah.
So you put together, maybe you're doing a whole bunch of you know, short videos, and then you decide, I'm going to do a special video. It's going to focus on this one thing, or this is the full documentary as opposed to the 6 or 8 snippets that I've shown you. The 6 or 8 snippets are free. They're 3 minutes, 5 minutes a piece. The whole video is an hour, and it's $6. You know, three if you want to rent it, six if you want to own it. And I feel like
you can set the price yourself, I think.
Yeah, I mean, and there's a barrier to entry. It's like $200 a year or something like that. I really didn't research the story that much. But it's one of those things where I feel like Vimeo has that clout where they've separated themselves apart from YouTube. Like, they're not about cat videos. You know, they're about some more cerebral content, if I can put it that way.
Yeah, yeah. At least they focus on high quality professional content. Yeah.
Yes.
YouTube's pretty much a free for all.
Yeah.
And yeah, when you type stop motion into YouTube, you end up with a lot of like balls of clay being picked, you know, just moved around a little bit here and there, and it's just like, that's not what I'm looking for, man.
Shot with the webcam.
Yeah, right. You know, Vimeo is quite good, and the idea of, you know, the creator getting about, I think it's like 90% of what their business model is talking about, the creator getting back. So, you know, you can afford to sell your video for, if it's a short, for like, you know, $2, right?
Right.
And then you still retain, you know,
$1.90 out of that. Yeah,
$1.80, $1.90 out of that.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. Very cool. Yeah. Very cool. Bill, do you use the Vimeo app on Apple TV?
I do not have an Apple TV,
but you did.
I use it on an iPhone, iPad.
Hmm.
A bit.
Okay. I've used it on Apple TV quite a bit, and there's been an update to the YouTube app in the last bit of software on the Apple TV, and it's a little bit easier to use. Plus, now that I have an iPad, I almost prefer to use YouTube on the iPad and then just use AirPlay. But Vimeo, surfing Vimeo and the discovery stuff on Vimeo on the Apple TV is very cool in a lean back kind of experience where you just like, you search for paint or you search for, you know, animation, and then you just kind of like lean back and find what pops up, you know, like I really feel like it's a nice kind of compliment to your TV in experiencing things that you don't normally experience on TV. So right on. So Bill, what about you? What has been on your screen this week?
This weekend I took my newly five-year-old son Liam to see Oz the Great and Powerful. You said you guys hadn't seen it yet, right?
No, we haven't.
Okay. I'm just gonna say that Oz is a sled and that Dorothy was dead the whole time. Now that we have the spoilers out of the way, no. it was a really good movie. Like, it's been getting a lot of hate, both from people. I think a lot of people are going into it expecting it to be The Wizard of Oz, and it's not The Wizard of Oz. It's not Return to Oz either, if you've ever seen that movie from the 80s. Mm-hmm. It's not as dark as that, but it is darker. But I thought it was really well done, and it was really nice to see a new fairy tale live action movie or TV miniseries or whatever that didn't involve the character from the original story being a grown up hip chick or guy going back to Wonderland or Oz or whatever. Cause you know, Alice in Wonderland, the movie did that Tin Man miniseries sci-fi did a couple years back did that. And you know, if I was going to list the amount of comic books that have done that is like a short miniseries or something, we'd be here all night.
Yeah.
So it was really nice to kind of see just another story in the world that didn't necessarily involve the original main character all grown up.
I've heard stuff like, you know, they're giving Oz the, you know, episode one treatment from Star Wars, that it's a whole lot of, you know, unthought out kind of, they're depending on the original movie and that it didn't need a remake or reboot or prequel. So does it do justice to separating itself, or do you have to have seen The Wizard of Oz before you go see this?
Well, it's a little of both. They do a really good job of, you know, paying homage and kind of doing this a lot of the same things stylistically as the original movie. Like, one thing I want to mention, and this really isn't a spoiler because if you've seen a trailer or some promo shots, you know it already. Basically, the first 5 or 10 minutes of the movie are all in black and white and all in a 4:3 aspect ratio. So it's kind of like how we all remember watching Wizard of Oz when we were growing up. When did they show it? I don't know when they showed it in Canada, but on Thanksgiving here, I think.
Okay.
But it starts out like that, and then it grows, and they have a lot of callbacks to the fact that, you know, the original was a musical and things like that. But it really does a good job. And as someone who was a huge fan of the Oz series of books growing up, I think it was a much better portrayal of Oz itself, the land, not the wizard. You got a really good sense of the fact that this is a world unto itself like ours, but different. It's big and expansive, and there's all sorts of different factions and races and people. And I thought it did a much better job doing that than the original movie. Although, you know, the original movie is a classic. You can't knock The Wizard of Oz.
Yeah, right, yeah.
You're going to get drug out into the streets. But yeah, it did a little of both. Really, the only thing I have to complain about the movie is the casting of Mila Kunis. I didn't think she was a very good fit for the role she got at all. Some people are considering the role she plays a bit of a spoiler, so I won't go into details on that.
Sure. But, well, the movie just came out this weekend, didn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. Yeah, we can hold off on that.
Yeah, but I just think she was horribly miscast. She would have been a better... I think she would have been a really good Glenda the Good Witch. But Michelle Williams did a great job as Glenda and her real-world counterpart. Because like the original movies, there's real-world counterparts for all of the main characters within Oz in the first 10 minutes or so.
Right. Mm-hmm. See, the thing that I find interesting about that is because I like Mila Kunis. I find her a good actor. I've seen her in a couple of things that I really enjoy.
Yeah, me too. I think she was just miscast this time.
Yeah, and it's James Franco that I can't stand.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Yes. I have yet to see something that I like
him. It seems like Hollywood is really trying to make this guy a star. And, yeah, and seeing Michelle Williams is like, you know, I don't know.
Anyway. Well, I do have to admit... There were a few moments in his performance where I totally saw his stoner characters from Freaks and Geeks and Pineapple Express. And I was like, oh, well, I'm sure he's enjoying the nice, colorful Oz. You know, it's like a world-sized blacklight poster or something.
Yeah. I keep on seeing him from Spider-Man 2 when he's talking about ruling the world. We're gonna make it happen, Harry. We're gonna make it happen. And I can't get it out of my head. Because I mean, again, same director too. So did you feel like Sam Raimi, you know, father of Spider-Man 3, handled Oz well?
He did. There were a lot of classic Raimi tropes, like, you know, big long fingernails clawing through the ground as someone gets pulled back into a dark void, things like that.
Yeah.
There was a dance number with jazz. No, I'm kidding.
Yeah, that's good. I'm glad you're getting with that.
I thought he did a good job directing the movie. I guess I read somewhere last week as the movie was coming out, though, that he said he's not going to come back for the sequel, which is unfortunate because you like to see consistency. But then again, his history with sequels, well, you know, that might not be such a good idea.
Well, I feel like the thing with Raimi is that he does pretty well when he's produced and he's able to direct. But I feel like the stuff that I've seen where he's been both the producer and the director and doesn't really have a whole lot of people to answer to is when he really gets off the rails. And that's where that's where I have to get off the train. It's like, oh, okay, wow, you have lost me, you know, and that kind of stuff I find hard to swallow when he kind of does his own thing. I feel like it's the same thing when, not that Quentin Tarantino ever does something that isn't kind of like from the gut, but I feel like I like so few of Tarantino's movies. The ones that I do like are the ones that are much closer to kind of what most people considered a normal movie. Mm-hmm. Whereas when it's really cerebral and really kind of, you know, the kind of story that he just has to tell, he loses me. And that's not saying anything against Tarantino. I mean, lots of people like him.
I forgot we discussed this last time I was on. You're one of those Tarantino haters.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Again, like, how many movies have I made? None, you know, but I mean, everybody's a critic, and I guess we all like what we like. Yeah. I mean, I say that. I mean, like, I'm also the guy that watched 10 seasons of Smallville. Like, I am not without my faults. I mean, season 5, woof. Like, you know, there's a lot of things that I've had to, you know, that I still say, well, you know, it's campy, but it's Superman, and I guess I'll watch it. And like, I have to, you know, everybody has to kind of figure out what that balance is, you know, the good with the bad. So what was your... what was your favorite thing about the movie then?
My favorite thing about the movie, I mean, just as a whole, it was really, really good. I think probably my favorite thing though was watching my son's reactions to it.
Nice,
because you know we've gone to see we've been going to see movies for a few years now. I think the first movie I took him to see was Toy Story 3. But for the most part, they've been those kind of cartoons, CGI animated movies like that, or I took him to see Rise of the Guardians, Gnomeo and Juliet, you know, that kind of the crap that kids like. But this was the first really kind of not adult movie, because that would be probably illegal, but, you know, kind of more mature movie, more intense with fantasy violence, things like that, that I've taken him to see. And it was just, he was just sitting there going, oh, my God. Oh, my God. And the black and white thing, when it transitioned from black and white 4:3 to color, you know, what it 1:22, whatever, the film aspect ratio, his eyes just got so wide. And it still played just like it did, you know, when we were kids.
Yeah.
And Dorothy walks out that door, you know. Yeah. So it was really cool to see that, you know, with him with all of his modern sensibilities and his Phineas and Ferbs and Power Rangers and whatnot, that he was still, that still affected him. So watching his reactions to everything was probably my favorite part of the movie. Right, but on. It was a good movie overall.
So, well, that's good to know, because I've got, I've got mixed reviews coming in from all fronts, but it's good to have someone that we've had on the show and an opinion I value say it's actually worth seeing.
Oh, yeah, I will say, you know, because when I was going to see it, my wife was mentioned to me that she had seen nothing but horrible reviews for it from all of her friends and her mommy blog circles and all that kind of stuff. And I was kind of shocked because all I had seen, you know, on sites like Bleeding Cool and things like that were positive reviews. And I was taking a look at some of the negative opinions on it, and I think people either went in expecting it to be The Wizard of Oz, the original movie, or expecting it to be Wicked, the musical.
They're
very passionate fans of that musical, and that musical involves pretty much all the characters that are in this movie. But it's a different story, and it's not quite as it's not painted as empowering to I won't even say women, but like the feminine side of things. And a big part of the plot has to do with a couple of the witches pining over the Wizard of Oz. And I think that going in expecting something that's very pro-female, or at least feminine tendencies, and getting, you know, basically a love triangle story,
romance sort of thing thrown in their face.
yeah. So I think that I thought it was a really good movie overall. I think a lot of the people who didn't like it, they were just looking for something else, and this movie wasn't it for them. I went in just expecting a story set in Oz. I think I'd seen one trailer and the promo poster. So you know, I really didn't know what to expect, and I had a really good time.
Yeah, very, very cool. So what, I know that we teased earlier in the show about another movie that you may not be so excited about.
Yeah. So, you know, I was sitting here today, and I looked over at the tweet stream, saw that there was a Kickstarter to revive an old canceled TV show, which personally I loved as a movie, Veronica Mars. And I was like, oh, very cool. I always wanted them to get one more shot at telling a Veronica Mars story. I click on the link. I watch the video. It's entertaining. I start reading through the text on the page and start reading through the article that sent me there and everything. And come to find out, I was assuming they were doing a Kickstarter to buy the IP and finance the movie. But actually, Warner Brothers still owns the IP, and they're going to make the movie, and Warner Brothers is going to distribute it. But they're just asking for $2 million from the fans to kind of, take care of the research and marketing.
Yeah.
You know, show that, interest in the movie.
That was bound to happen eventually, I guess.
I am surprised that Kickstarter let this happen.
I know, to be quite honest, I had never backed a Kickstarter before. I think I had backed a couple projects on Indiegogo, but I'd never backed a Kickstarter before. And then yesterday I backed Tom Merritt and Len Peralta's Kickstarter. And then today this happened, and I don't think I want to give Kickstarter my 2% of whatever I donate to a content creator I actually want to support after accepting this project. It's just...
Yeah. Like, yeah, for me, it's like, I feel like there needs to be either some sort of clearer mission statement from Kickstarter. Like, they made a shift of gears. I think it was late 2012, might have been early 2013, where they said, look, we don't want to be a pre-order process. You know, if you've got an idea and you've got a prototype and you want to raise money for manufacturing because you're a small company or whatever, like, that's cool. But we don't want to be like, hey, I don't know how many of these to make, so I'm going to gauge it and all this kind of stuff. I feel like a lot of people are expecting stuff from Kickstarter. Like, they want to buy a thing. They want to walk away with the fact that they are going to get the thing that they're supporting, be it a movie or an object or a, you know, like a book. But then they also want to be a part of, you know, making that possible. But I think that Kickstarter is also something that could actually fund, you know, ideas in art installations or, you know, mom and shop playhouses that want to put on a play and they don't have the resources to do the kind of things that they need. And I feel like there's a boom for it to go that direction. And I don't know why they keep on letting these, you know, multi-million dollar, I guess, entities start Kickstarters. It's like, you have access to the higher-ups. What do they call them? The brass at Warner Brothers?
Yeah.
If you can pull up a chair next to anybody that's considered brass at Warner Brothers, you shouldn't be allowed to do a Kickstarter.
The thing that really got me going and angry about it was the fact that they're looking for a $5 million budget to make the movie, $2 million of which they were hoping to raise on Kickstarter. $5 million, many executives, their breakfast costs more than $5 million. Like, it's not a big deal, and it's a known property, a known IP that would get a complete return investment, which got me thinking, you know, the bean counters at the WB, when they were approached with this project, you know, they run numbers, they run stats and everything, try and see if the project is it will be profitable for them, or most likely profitable for them. I think they ran those numbers, realized it would, but also realized they had a really golden opportunity here to see if it was viable to double dip into consumers' pockets, to have them take the assumed risk of funding the project as well as paying for the product at the end of production. And, you know, it just seemed like a very, because this is one of very few IPs you could do this with and get away with it and have the passion of the internet behind it. Basically, this in Firefly, but Firefly is monetarily prohibitive to make because of all the special effects and the big, huge sets and everything. Veronica Mars, when it comes down to it, you could have several of the characters in a kitchen for the entire movie, and it would still be an interesting movie. You know, so I think it was very calculated by Warner Brothers to try. It's a trial balloon, more or less, to see if this sort of thing is viable. And they're working towards the narrative of grassroots campaign revives geek favorite TV series. And that's it, as far as I've seen on the interwebs today, that's exactly what they're getting. And I think that's what upsets me so much about it, is that, one, it's such a cynical ploy to double dip, and two, they were really smart with it, and it's going to work.
Yeah, and they've raised $5,000 in the time that it's taken you to explain it on this show.
Exactly. Exactly.
Yeah. I'm watching it go up by $100 every 10 seconds.
It's ridiculous.
Yeah.
And so, you know, be prepared in a couple years to be paying on Kickstarter for your also ad supported, you know, Survivor Season 24.
Yeah. I feel like, I don't know.
Kickstarter just moved into Europe as well this week.
Oh, did they?
Really?
Yeah, they just launched in Europe. So they, yeah, you'll be seeing a lot, you know, like, they're a corporation now, are they?
Yeah.
You
know, well, cough, Kickstarter. Where's the Canadian contingent?
Yeah. Yeah. Well,
you know, I mean, at the same time, there are people that are running Kickstarter projects for the right reasons, and they're being successful for the right reasons. So I guess now it's been pretty, I mean, either Kickstarter is now trying to figure out what the hell they're supposed to do about this, because, I mean, like I said, it's going to fund by the end of the show. Or they are okay with it and taking a step in that direction. And now it's going to land on the average Joe. It's going to land on the consumer that's paying the $10, $20, $40 reward level as to what you back. You know, speak with your pocketbook. You know, like if you don't agree with this kind of stuff, then don't back this kind of stuff. You know.
Yeah, I guess what they're doing, they're putting the probably putting like the merchandising aspect of a project like that on the front end of it before it's even made. Like, you know, you get $50, you get a ticket for the show plus a T-shirt. Or whatever it is they would do, right?
Well, that's the thing is that I've read through some of the rewards and I don't remember seeing like a ticket to opening night or anything.
Nice.
Bill, I think there's a level. I think it's $35 to get a digital download, $50 to get a DVD, and $100 to get a Blu-ray. Right. And that you get that a couple weeks after the movie comes out.
Hmm.
You don't even get like early access or anything.
Hmm.
Well, I guess with doing that though, you'll probably end up with that movie being hugely pirated, right?
Yeah, basically. Well, I mean, the prime demo for this show is also the prime demo of the pirate stuff.
Yeah, pretty much.
So yeah, eight guys throw the $30 in for the download, and then boom, just distribute it on their own, right? Throw it on the torrent sites, and away you go.
Exactly. It, one other thing that bugs me about this is this, if this works for them, which obviously, as we mentioned, it's almost funded already, and it launched this morning, it's going to, is that this allows the studios to take away the only value that they added to the creative process for creating movies and TV shows, which was assuming that financial risk, and just completely throw it away. So basically, all they're doing is just kind of, you know, holding the film while it's edited and then putting it out there and reaping the profits from it.
Yeah.
It's just a shame.
Yeah. Do you know of any distributors that have tried to do a Kickstarter, like an up-and-comer that might be trying to, you know, I mean, I know there's been Kickstarters for films and documentaries and directors and stuff to kind of, you know, complete these, you know, passion projects and get them out there. But, you know, have there been any Kickstarters for where like, you know, hey, we are a small distribution, you know, company for, I don't know, like documentaries or something is the first thing that comes to mind, possibly animated shorts, I don't know, to then distribute that kind of stuff. I guess that's probably what that cartoon channel was. Well, hey, Peyton.
Yeah, I think so. Just try to do it on their own with the idea of, you know, having a fair pay system, whether for the creators and showcasing different people and all that stuff. Huh. But you know, yeah, I don't know. It just, the internet's so big that how do you get people to come to that? You know, part of, you know, you have your content, you know, and you got a bit of a community, but how do you put the commerce there, you know? Mm-hmm. Or if you got the content and you've got the commerce part, but you don't have the community, like, why would they come to you, right? So
yeah, chicken
before it's like guys. Joel was saying towards the beginning of the episode, you know, there's so many options out there, there's so much noise that it's hard to really like kind of tunnel in and focus on one thing, and you know the things you really, really love, and you know how to tunnel into those things. But you know, discovery is becoming a major problem across the board.
I know another thing Kickstarter did a little while ago as well is they had a problems with people who were coming in with just not even prototypes, just concepts, and they were getting these huge funding dollars for it, and then they were like, okay, well, you know, I got this thing for this watch. I got this idea. Here's a sketch of it. Here's a 3D rendering of it. It looks all good and pretty. You know, you give me $50,000 and I'll get it made. I end up making $2 million, and at the end of it, they can't actually produce the item. So yeah. I think in some cases for some tech items, they actually want to have a working prototype in their hand and say, here it is, right? So.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway,
yeah,
they're less than $9,000 away from getting their funding target.
Yeah, oh, it's gone through $20,000 in the time that we've been talking about it. Yeah, it's I don't know. As an independent creator, I mean, I know both Peyton and I are just kind of sitting here. Well, I mean, YouTube Bill just kind of cringing and kind of going
steaming.
Like, oh my god, like that. I mean, you know what? I'll throw it out there. $30,000 is what I made last year.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, and that's been 15 minutes.
Yeah.
You know, and that kind of stuff. It's like, I mean, I know that movies are expensive and there's a lot of different stuff going on, but I just, it gets to the point where my brain just can't even compute. You know, it's like that to me, Kickstarter now to me is the same as the billboard for the Atlantic Lottery when I drive by. you know, on the bridge. It's like, oh, that's a really big number that I'll never see. Like, you know, and like Kickstarter doesn't, you know, the experience that I had, you know, with my Indiegogo campaign back in October, there. I guess, September. I mean, like, I raised enough money to print my book. The book was done. You know, the master was finished. All I needed was basically the capital to then print the copy so that people could get them. And in purchasing a book, you know, the profit that I would make from that purchase went into funding the print, the printing process. I mean, I think my goal was something like $2,700, you know, I think it was 36 in the end with some stretch goals for nicer paper and a nicer cover. But like that was, you know, that to me seemed like the kind of thing that these services are really meant to do and meant to help out.
Well, that was probably the initial concept for them, right? Yeah. Now, the thing with Kickstarter as well is they have a much larger community of people who are coming there. Like, well, they just hit a target.
Yeah, they just funded.
Yeah, and they have you know, they have an app and everything for it now, right? So it's, you know, they do a very good job of branding the Kickstarter idea.
Absolutely.
And even the name itself, right? And then you have other people coming in, you know, late to the party, like Indiegogo, you know, who, you know, if you're in the States, you're on Kickstarter. If you're anywhere else, like in Canada, you're on Indiegogo, unless you have someone in the States. But, you know, you don't have the same community. That, and there's other ones, like there's a Rocket Hub or something.
I think Rocket Hub.
Maybe.
And one of them is a comic site, and the other one is a crowdfunding site. And you're right. Yeah. I looked at that one, too.
So then, you know, you're like, well, which one do you put your efforts into, right? And then, you know, you're at the behest of your own social network. So, you know, you might have a couple hundred friends on Facebook and you're asking them and all that stuff, and that gets tired pretty quick. And, you know, unless you get picked up by some popular podcast or, you know,
maybe
a small podcast like us.
Well, and that's the other thing too, that, I mean, this is going to be changing a lot, especially in Canada, I think, because some of the consulting that I was doing over the last couple of months led me to meet some very interesting people that are in some large, you know, media board companies. And one of the things that I was made aware of that's going on in Canada right now is the legislative meetings that are going to allow crowdfunded equity to be legal in Canada. So right now you can crowdfund a project, but you can't crowdfund capital for a company.
Okay.
But that is coming.
Oh, okay.
Right? So, I mean, like, if you are a company that is going to be a service, or, you know, you're a whatever that happens to be, design, web design, maybe you provide email service to professionals, whatever it is that you do, if you have a startup and you have what you think is a valuable service to offer, you can't really Kickstarter that because there's no product per se. So this idea of crowdfunding equity in the company is going to be moving forward. It's whether or not it happens soon or not, I don't know. But, I mean, it really feels like an inevitable train. And really, like, for good ideas and for good companies and for people that have good startup stuff, I mean, that's probably a good thing. Like, you know, instead of trying to go to angel investors that have all the money and all the power and all the decision making, and maybe they're not the best people to deal with, maybe they're not the people, they don't share your vision, whereas you can just go to your potential customers and say, look, I know that you need this email app or this email plugin desperately, because we all do. We're all complaining about it constantly online. Well, we, as, you know, email company X, are going to provide that to you. The problem is we need some capital to actually establish ourselves as a company, create, you know, stuff for you, software or services, or, you know, staff or office, so that we can actually do this. And again, if enough people are behind it, then as long as it at some point becomes legal, then it will move forward.
I guess for You could probably do fundraising for a film concept with that idea as well. So you know, set up like a film corporation, and then
Like a co-op.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it's not all, you know, money bags and the rich getting richer, in terms of, you know, where things might go with crowdfunding. But I try to see the silver lining. But I'm with you, Bill. It's hard to see with, you know, when the Super Star Destroyer is blocking out the sun. It's kind of hard to see the silver lining on the bottom of the clouds.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's one of those moments throughout the year where you have to kind of analyze the situation and figure out where you stand and, you know, basically make a decision based on where you stand. And I think the decision that, you know, everyone's excited, there's going to be a Veronica Mars movie. But when it comes down to it, do you want... There's two ways to go about a crowdfunding site. There's completely open, like something like Indiegogo, which, Joel, you've done, and I've personally done and had great experiences with. Mm-hmm. Or there's something that's supposedly curated or moderated, like Kickstarter. And both of them promise to kind of give the power to the people, you know, circumvent the big guys and allow people to create art that they want to create on their own terms. But Kickstarter's decision today, I think, really hit me over the head with the fact that they might not be all about that. And you just have to make a decision whether you want your 1 or 2% or whatever Kickstarter or Indiegogo gets. If you want it to go somewhere that claims to be a curated experience for artists to showcase and fund their work, yet allows a major Hollywood studio to put a project up, or you want to go with something like Indiegogo that's completely open, less accountability. But I personally can feel a little bit better morally giving to a project over there, because I know that my money is going to the small fry, the small guy, the guy who's trying to knock down the years of barriers that all these big companies have built behind themselves, mm-hmm. to really trying to put something out there in the world. So it's just one of those situations where you have to analyze the situation and figure out where you stand and what you want to do with it, I guess.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I guess we can wrap up the Kickstarter talk and move into something on a little bit more of a positive note, which is server crashes at Comixology. Peyton, mm-hmm. did you try to read comics this weekend?
Yes, one of the many. Yeah, I got up on Monday there, and I saw that the day before they had announced that Marvel was being very generous, and they were going to put out a bunch of their first issue comics for free for people to try out different series and stuff like that, which, you know, I'm always interested in doing.
By a bunch, you mean 700.
700, yeah. So I guess they thought, well, maybe these guys, you know, because comic nerds aren't, you know, like myself, we're not collectors. We don't try to hoard as many comics as you can get your hands on. So, you know, you basically put your finger through the iPad as you're hitting them, like, download, 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 right? So anyway, I'm doing it there, and I'm going through it, and I'm like, I'm going to try to read one of them, and it says, like, download error. I'm like, oh, okay. And then I try to go on the Comixology website, and there's nothing. Like, oh. Anyway, apparently it was just like the hand of God came down the servers and went, what you doing? You're not going to do that. That's silly. Anyway, so they ended up... I'm not quite sure what's happening right now, but if you did have anything that we got the message download error, I guess your account recognized that you did actually quote unquote purchase the item, so it will be on your account eventually once they get the problem fixed. But it totally crashed the entire Comixology website. So it's interesting because some people from some companies like Marvel and DC also have their own standalone apps and websites where you can go to read these things. But smaller companies, I'm not sure if I think Image has their own and Dark Horse, but smaller companies than them don't have, you know, like basically Comixology is a monopoly for digital downloads. Mm-hmm. And so a lot of people were unable to even sell any of their comics at all. That's lost revenue and all that. So the CEO of the company came in and said, you know, we let you down. We thought we were prepared for this, but obviously we weren't and all this stuff. And thank you for your patience, et cetera, et cetera. But I guess this really is highlighting the idea of the monopoly like this and the crowd and you know, cloud computing and all that fun stuff. The idea that, you know, you can just go and download it at your leisure, right? And really, you can't, because before, you know, your powers of distribution were all based on, like, you know, how many issues can you actually print and get onto a truck to get to the comic book store. And now it's like, how big is how much bandwidth can you buy, right? And when you need it and all that stuff. And I guess this is just, you know, putting a little light on that sort of thing, because, you know, you go to your local Strange Adventures comic book store and, you know, comic books don't crash, you know.
Yeah.
If you lose power, light a candle, read your comics. It's still there, right? It's still awesome. So anyway, you know,
yeah.
free is free, but I don't know.
Do you guys feel like the drive and the, I guess, well, just the notion that, you know, the servers crashed, there was that much of a demand for this stuff. Do you think that might drive the price of digital downloads down? Because right now it's day and date and same price. So it's just a choice. Yeah. You either read it on a slightly smaller screen whenever you want and don't have to store a book, or you go to the comic store and you buy a copy for the same dollar value. So what do you think, that there might be a drop in price happening with comics?
I doubt it. I think that with the rise of the higher resolution screens like the Retina display, especially as you get to like desktop models, you know, like a 24-inch iMac with a Retina display, and you go and you're reading your comics on that, you know, those files are getting much larger than the, you know, when Comixology and those websites were first founded, right?
Mm-hmm.
So the data sizes are only going to get bigger and bigger and bigger, especially as you're adding more little bits of animation and all the bells and whistles and whatever.
Oh, I definitely want to draw a line and separate, you know, the traditional just comic book in a digital form versus like an animated comic book or motion graphic novel or something.
Yeah.
I'm just talking like traditional comics.
Yeah, I don't think they would do that because as well, like, you know, they might not have to pay. They might have to pay a little more, you know, as these files are getting bigger. But they don't have to print it. They don't have to do any distributions in the traditional sense.
Mm.
And the creators and the illustrators are not getting a penny more.
No.
For illustrating these books and writing these books. So, you know, that's a big thing that they're all facing with there now, is trying to get, you know, a fair shake for their day's work, right? Mm. Or their days and nights and days and weekends work on making these comics. And, you know, like, I think I heard one time, like, an artist like Scotty Young, I think, you know, might make $2,500 on an issue.
Wow.
You know, and that's like a, you know, New York Times best-selling book, right?
Yeah.
You know, and he would only make maybe $2,500 on a total run for that one particular issue. And that's pretty sad for, you know, an artist of his caliber or people like that who are, you know, making a proper go of it, right? And then, you know, having, you know, maybe 70% of the actual issue that's in the stores go back to the, you know, through the middleman, which is distribution and the publishers and all that stuff, you know, that to cut all that out and have the publisher get that bigger chunk, you know, I don't know, man. Like the original comic companies all started by the mob back in the day anyway. So all in the same way, you know, you look at the creators, you know, they're all getting, you know, all getting screwed and like they were in prison or something, not in a nice way, right? But anyway, I'm going to rant about that, but I won't.
Well, I'm looking, actually, I'm clicking on Google Plus right now because I created this webcomic community with my friends Matt and Brian from Comics Coast to Coast, and one of the guys on there posted something about Comixology taking submissions. So now a creator like myself can submit, you know, like my first book, Starcross Volume 1, to Comixology. And I'm just, as you were talking about the, you know, the cuts of the publishers and stuff, Peyton, it just kind of reminded me that there's a couple of cuts that come out of, you know, posting and submitting to Comixology. The first cut is to Comixology. The next cut, of course, is to Apple.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, Apple takes the 30% off the top, and then I can't remember what Comixology takes, but it's in the vein of like 10 or 20%. And it just, the question that that was raised was like, you know, is that enough? You know, like, is that enough for you to get on Comixology as a creator? Like, because, I mean, if I'm selling a $10 book, then all of a sudden I'm only getting, you know, barely above what I paid to print the damn thing just to get it out on Comixology. So at one point does that, you know, it doesn't make more, I mean, it doesn't make sense. I mean, I don't know that I'm going to make, you know, that much being on Comixology.
Yeah.
The thing is with Comixology and things like it, you're not really paying for the e-commerce software so much as you're paying for the access to their audience.
Yeah, the accessibility, yeah.
And I mean, still, you know, it's still very early days, especially for digital portable mobile comics. But, you know, within a couple of years, like, that audience is going to be the premium that you're going to be going for, because, you know, you could go and sell your comic on your site. And, I mean, if you have, I don't know, 500 visitors every week or something like that, you know, law of averages, statistics, stuff like that, you're going to get one or two people who pick up your book. Yeah. But if someone's going somewhere to buy comics and they know this is a place where you can get good comics for your iPad, your iPhone, whatever, that's they're definitely going to be more likely to buy your product than not, or just stumble across it. Cause
yeah, you can also, you know, take the hit and throw the free one up on there, and then,
yeah,
you know, then in the back of the comic, you lead them back to your website where they can purchase from you. Maybe, yeah. Although if you're doing that with Apple, you probably can't sell it anywhere else.
No. Well, and this is the thing. Yeah. And actually, to correct myself, it is, creators retain all rights to their work, and offerings, and sales are split 50-50 between the creator and Comixology.
Okay.
The exception in sales, of course,
is after
Apple users, which are splitting, there's a 30% to Apple, and then the remaining 35-35 between creator and Comixology. So that's a much bigger chunk than 10 or 20%. I'm sorry, I made that mistake.
Yeah.
So, wow. I mean, right there, I mean, all of a sudden it's like, well, I get a third of my book. I mean, it's better than a tenth if I was to, you know, try to go through a traditional publisher and try to put it in chapters or something.
Yeah. Well, it's just a matter of finding a way to build the community itself, right?
Like, yeah.
You know, look at someone like Louis C.K., you know, he went and circumvented the entire, like...
The whole system.
The network system for making a special. The Ticketmasters, he circumvented that, and then he went and circumvented iTunes by distributing it through his own website.
Yeah.
And with Ticketmaster, like, if you were to buy a Louis C.K. ticket and you were trying to scalp it, you could only scalp it for the same price you paid for it.
Right.
Anyway, so, you know.
Interesting. Interesting. Well, I actually had a short mention here in the reading section, and it goes back to what I mentioned earlier in the show about Twitter, and that is a local story about Nova Scotian maple trees, sugar maples, to be precise. And one of the things that I really enjoy about reading the news on Twitter about my hometown is that I get positive news. I get the news about the fire in Spryfield or about the stabbing at the pizza place, but I can glaze over those headlines and I don't have to be beaten over the head with it. They go by very quickly, and they kind of go in one ear and out the other, I guess, or in one eye and out the other. But this is about a local kind of family business here in Nova Scotia. The McCormick clan has some sugar woods out near Truro. And a couple of big points that kind of hit home for me, which I thought was really quite cool. There are 375,000 taps province-wide, so not owned by this particular company, but province-wide, that will yield more than 140,000 liters of maple syrup to importers, exporters. Like, I mean, it's sold locally, it's exported to different locations, and that will go for, in a 4-liter jug to like a retailer, you're looking at $45 to $60.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and then it goes up from there to the end consumer. And I did not realize what a booming business that maple syrup was. I mean, I know it's expensive when I see it on the grocery store shelf compared to table syrup and just, you know, butter flavored syrup and stuff like that. But I didn't realize how well it was doing locally. And the other thing that I didn't know was that they actually have some government support. For once, you know, a really good government-related story where instead of selling the land for whatever the land is worth and cutting the trees down and selling the trees for whatever they're worth, the government is moving to protect the sugar maples and the surrounding forests because, as it turns out, they're worth more if they're left standing and tapped for maple syrup.
Nice.
I mean, I want to, you know, kind of scream a great big duh, but at the same time, it's just, it's nice to hear. It's positive. I don't want to nick on it at all. I mean, it was a really fun story. The guy's son has become like the head boiler at the Sugarwoods place where the plant where they make everything. So it's a really, really neat story. And if you're at all interested in where maple syrup comes from in Nova Scotia, then I would encourage you reading it because it's really fun. It was a nice kind of start to the day.
That's a great
now I just want a stack of pancakes.
Yeah, I'm just thinking of the sun with a business card. Hi, I'm John. I'm a boiler.
Yeah.
Are you still a serial killer? What's going on with that? There's a Maplewood from Sugar Moon, I think it is, up around Tatamagush, and you can go up there as well and get a bunch of big restaurant with like pancake breakfasts and all that stuff. These might have the same thing, but it's a lot of fun to, you know, roll maple syrup on the snow. I did that was like 2 years ago.
Yeah,
it was amazing.
really fun. Actually, you know, it's funny that you mentioned Sugar Moon. I'm wondering if Garrison Brewery here in the city actually work with that Sugar Moon maple place, because they do a beer, a spring beer called Sugar Moon, and it is amazing. Mm. And it's a maple beer.
Ah, could be.
Maple beer.
Yeah, there's a lot of craft brewing happening around here, Bill, and it is amazing. Really, really good stuff. Non-filtered, doesn't have to go very far. A lot of dark beers, a lot of heavy hoppy ales and stuff. Justin and I really, really enjoy it. But the maple beer, a lot of them have, like, you know, their six packs and stuff that's available year round, but they always have seasonals. Like the winter is like a Russian Imperial, it's a stout. The fall, there's like a pumpkin ale, and there's one other one too, a really hoppy one. And then in the springtime, you get the maple beer. And then I think they do like a light lager, or like a, not a pale ale, but almost like a pilsner in the summertime. Mm-hmm. So yeah, it's good news for springtime years, because I mean, geez, spring is next week.
Yeah. The year is barreling along.
Yeah.
No matter how much I'm still clinging to January, somehow we're in March.
Yeah. Right on. Well, we can probably wrap this up here with the Internet Minute. We're a little bit long this evening, but what do you guys have to share with the crowd? Anything in particular you've seen online?
You go ahead there, Mr. Meeks, if you wish.
Okay, I just, and this is something that it's been a thorn in my side for a while, for a couple of years, because I've had an Android phone, and I just got an iPhone, and ironically, I found a solution after I got an iPhone and didn't have the problem anymore. But basically, there's especially more of the corporate podcasts. Like, I found this tool because I ran into it looking for the official Once Upon a Time podcast. You know, they'll just put it on iTunes, and they won't publish an RSS feed for you to subscribe to anywhere for a podcast, which is really annoying when you want to watch it and you don't want to have iTunes on your computer or whatever. Basically what this podcast URL extractor does, and I'm guessing, Joel, you'll probably put the link in the show notes.
Show notes, it's already in the chat room as well.
Yeah. Oh, excellent. Yeah, it's itunes.so-nik.com, which is why I wanted to make sure you were going to put it somewhere for everyone. But basically what you do is if you can find the iTunes store link, you go to this website, you pop it in, and it spits out the RSS feed. Really small, simple tool, but something that blew my mind when I found it this week and was kicking myself for not finding it 2 years ago. So if you run into that particular niche problem, podcast URL extractor.
Awesome. I can imagine that would be very handy, because I've switched over. I'm no longer using the Apple Podcasts app. I'm now using Downcast.
Oh, yeah. That thing's crap. Yeah. Downcast is great.
Yeah. I really like Downcast on the iPad. It's very, very cool. Peyton, that's what we were using, actually, when you were hanging out here last week. We were using Downcast. But also, because it's not tied into my iTunes account or anything like that, I have to go find the URLs and the RSS feeds from podcasts manually. Sometimes it's just a matter of copying a link, but other times it's not so easy, so I will have to check that out.
Yeah, they actually have a pretty decent search function in Downcast, too. My podcast was there, and I don't remember submitting it. So.
Yeah, no, I do find a lot of them via search, but I also have the problem of now having to go, like, research and resubscribe to a lot of the stuff that I've been listening to. So, yeah. Peyton, what about you?
My Internet Minute pick for this week is is a gaming link, actually. I'm not a big gamer, but my wife and I have recently been talking a bit about generals and all that stuff. And there was a dad who has a 3-year-old daughter, and his daughter wanted to play Donkey Kong, but she wanted to play the princess saving Mario. So the dad, being a programmer and along with one of his buddies, they went in and hacked the game and change it so that the princess saves Mario, and it changed like some of the items in the game to like female friendly things, like little girl things like umbrellas and stuff like that. And it's just really neat that that someone can do something like that, and it's possible, right? It's really cool to do that, because the game industry itself seems to be dragging its heels a little bit. They don't really, I don't know, don't seem to really get the idea that girls are awesome gamers as well. Mm-hmm. You know, anyway, just kind of fun to do that for your kid.
You know? Yeah, absolutely. I, being the boyfriend to a girl gamer, I heard about that over dinner last night.
Oh,
yeah.
Yeah, yeah, I actually saw this too. I used to be, back when I was a teenager, I was a big NES ROM hacker. So this hit all my buttons. This story.
What is it? Down, down, left, right, up, start, A, B. I can't remember the code.
It's A, B, A. I can't remember it either.
Yeah. It's a pretty standard pattern I used to have memorized for all my SNES
games. Yeah, it's one of those things you have stored in muscle memory and not actually corresponding to actual physical names.
Precisely. That's exactly
yeah.
it.
Yeah, my move essentially smash, smash, smash your hand against the keys, scream, throw it, be laughed at by a 4-year-old. You can't play this.
Yeah.
Shut up.
Yeah. Peyton plays Nintendo like my mom.
Yeah. So bad.
Too funny. Well, ladies and gentlemen, that brings us nicely and neatly to the end of this episode of the Citadel Cafe. As I mentioned at the top of the show, you can find us here every Wednesday night at 8 p.m. Eastern on not starcrossedonline.com, but joelduggan.com/live. Mm-hmm. Moved the show feed over to a happy new home. Mm-hmm. The music for the Citadel Cafe was composed by Kevin MacLeod, and of course the podcast is available via iTunes and possibly not iTunes. If you don't have it, you can just check out Bill's link and find the Citadel Cafe at the CitadelCafe.com. That's where our RSS feed resides. You can contact the show via Gmail at the Citadel Cafe, as well as Twitter, Facebook, and Google+. It's all the same name. If you are on iTunes, please head on over to that location and leave us a iTunes review. More than happy to receive a 4-star or a 3-star, but we will love you forever if you give us a 5-star and leave some constructive feedback as well, because we're always happy to kind of move the show forward and improve. The Gamers Inn happens every Friday night at 9:30 my time, so that's 8:30 Eastern for all of you American folks. This week, Jocelyn and Ryan have more juicy gamer news for you guys. Tune into the Gamers Inn at gamersinpodcast.com or on amove.tv/TGI. My name is Joel Duggan. You can find my work at starcrossedonline.com and now also joelduggan.com. You can also find me on Twitter and Google+ with just my name. Peyton, where can people find you online?
CardboardTreehouse.com and Twitter at Peyton Francis. Yeah. And how about you, sir, Mr. Meeks? Where can people find you and your fine works?
Well, I have a website which features all of my creative output, MeeksMixedMedia.com. You can follow me on Twitter at Bill Meeks, and I suggest you follow me on Twitter and at Reply Me, because I have a 99.9% reply rate. So if you tweet at me, I will reply. And you can find me on Google+ as Bill Meeks. And also, I just wanted to mention too, I do a podcast, a weekly podcast with Anne-Marie Desimone called Greetings from Storybrooke, where we talk Once Upon a Time. So if you like Once Upon a Time, you can find us at greetingsfromstorybrooke.com or on iTunes. And we're really building up to the end of the season here. Things are getting very interesting. We're at the top of our game. You should definitely check it out if you haven't already.
Fantastic. Well, Bill, thanks so much for being on the show. Ladies and gentlemen, you have been listening to the Citadel Cafe, where we are fast, easy, and cheap, but you can only pick two.
Yeah, but that Kickstarter conversation, it was worth going long, man. That was really fun.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. And well, that's one of the things I like about the podcast, and what I like about the new hour-long format is that for the most part, when Peyton and I get busy, we don't have to scramble for content. Like, we can fill an hour. It's not really that difficult. Most of the shows lately have been around 45, 50 minutes. But when we do have something that can go into like the hour and 15, it's fine. You know, like it's nice that I don't have to cut the show. I there's nothing that comes on any kind of network after me. So like, I don't have to worry about that kind of stuff. Like, I know they struggle with that kind of stuff sometimes on Twitter, where there's a really good conversation happening, but they've got a show that happens like right after. And
yeah,
they've got to move on. And I know that that's going to be tough.
Well, you know what? If nothing else, I really appreciate the outlet to vent.
Oh, sure, man. No, I'm totally with you all the way.
It was just like I was a big ball of frustrated all day. And then right before the podcast started, I found out Google Reader was shutting down too. And I was like, oh, man, can this day get any worse? But then I came here and I talked to two friendly fellows like yourselves.
Yeah.
And I'm feeling pretty chipper.
Oh, well, thanks. Point.